Today is Wednesday, September 1st, and you're listening to International Additionally Voice of America. I am Chinua Adofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, UN agencies vow to remain in Afghanistan.
The armies have left, but the UN is staying, and we are committed to stay. And that's what we have said from the beginning, and that's what we are doing.
Plus, Russia seeks to fill U.S. vacuum in Afghanistan.
Moscow is very eager to take advantage of a perceived power vacuum, and so they are on the ground. They are not going to be removing their embassy.
Also, another COVID variant emerges in South Africa. Our top story today is in Afghanistan. The Taliban is sending reinforcements to the Panjshir Valley after clashes with rival militia killed several of its fighters on Monday night. Since the fall of Kabul on August 15th, the Panjshir has been the only province to hold out against the Taliban, although there has been fighting in a neighboring Baghlan province between Taliban and local militia forces. Fahim Dashti, a spokesman for the National Resistance Forces, or NRF, a group loyal to local leader Ahmad Massoud, said the fighting occurred on the western entrance to the valley, where the Taliban attacked the NRF positions. He said the attack was repulsed with 8 Taliban killed and a similar number wounded, while 2 members of the NRF forces were wounded. It was not immediately possible to reach a Taliban spokesman for comment. Massoud, son of the former anti-Soviet Mujahideen commander Ahmad Shah Massoud, has established himself in the Panjshir Valley with a force of several thousands made up of local militias and remnants of army and special forces units. He has called for a negotiated settlement with the Taliban, but has said his forces will resist if their province in the narrow valley is attacked. A significant force of Taliban fighters has been moving to the area, but the two sides have so far been engaged in negotiations and have avoided fighting. With the departure of international troops from Afghanistan, United Nations agencies pledge to remain in the beleaguered country and assist millions of people, many of whom are internally displaced. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The Taliban now is in charge of the country, but there is no centralized government in place. UN agencies say that is problematic. However, they note they've been talking with the Taliban and other groups for decades about accessing people in need. Spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Laerke, says he believes that experience will allow aid agencies to gain the necessary acceptance to carry out their life-saving operations.
The armies have left, but the UN is staying, and we are committed to stay. And that's what we have said from the beginning, and that's what we are doing. Just to remind you that we have already delivered humanitarian aid to some 8 million people this year alone. So I think that is simply a number that demonstrate that we are there to stay.
The United Nations aims to assist 16 million people this year, including 3.5 million people forcibly uprooted from their homes by conflict. However, it acknowledges that may not be possible, as it has received only 39% of the $1.3 billion humanitarian appeal. The World Health Organization succeeded in flying in 12.5 tons of medical supplies into the Mazar-e-Sharif airport in Afghanistan Monday. WHO spokeswoman Margaret Harris says much more is needed. She says the WHO is planning 2 further airlifts this week from the WHO's logistics hub in Dubai and is exploring other options to get more shipments into the country. She says the WHO is concerned that many non-governmental organizations are forced to scale down operations and close health facilities for lack of money. That, she says, is depriving millions of Afghans of necessary primary and secondary health care.
The range of services that will be impacted included immunization for children, antenatal care, postnatal care, and child delivery for pregnant women. Malnutrition care and COVID treatment centers and other essential health services will also be affected. It's estimated that the closure of every 50 health facilities could lead to the death of 5 more women and 58 more children under 5 years of age every day.
Aid agencies say they fear the tragedy that has been unfolding in Afghanistan will no longer be visible now that the airlifts out of Kabul have ended. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi warns a far greater humanitarian crisis is just beginning. He is urging nations to keep their borders open to Afghans fleeing persecution and conflict and who need international protection. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Deportation centers in Turkey are filled to capacity as refugees from Afghanistan continue to cross the border from Iran by night, hoping to evade police and resettle. As VOA tours a deportation center in Van, officials say they are not sending people back to Afghanistan, but they also have no plans to release detainees. VOA's Heather Murdoch has this report from Van and the Turkish border with Iran.
Refugees from Afghanistan say crossing this border from Iran to Turkey is a chance at freedom and safety after weeks or months of grueling travel from Afghanistan. But once they get across, many go into hiding, hoping to evade police and deportation. Those who are caught are often held in deportation camps. Many are children.
I was running from police and I fell in a deep ditch and broke my leg.
Turkish authorities take us on a tour of a deportation camp not far from the border. They say their goal is to prevent more refugees from entering Turkey to seek asylum, but they also want us to witness what appears to be generally humane treatment.
There are 126 rooms in this facility, all meeting international quality standards.
Officials say 80% of the people detained in this facility are from Afghanistan and they cannot be deported to their home country for logistical and humanitarian reasons. Earlier this month, the Taliban swept into Kabul after taking over vast swaths of Afghanistan in a matter of days. Since then, mass evacuations have left the Kabul airport in chaos, and Islamic State suicide bombers have killed at least 170 Afghan people and 13 U.S. service members. Now the country is on edge, waiting to find out what happens after the U.S. met its avowed August 31st deadline to pull out of Afghanistan completely. Officials say maybe next week or next month they can formulate a plan beyond resettling refugees in a third country, which is often impossible. Families say despite their uncertain future in Turkey or beyond, they had no choice but to leave.
It was war. Everything was deteriorating. We had to go.
Turkey hosts more than 4 million refugees and asylum seekers, more than any other country in the world. Many Turkish people say the refugee population is a strain on their economy. Soldiers say they are working hard to keep the refugees out. The government says it is not forcing people back across this border to Iran. But many refugees say they have entered Turkey and been forced back out many times. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Van and the Turkish border with Iran.
In the aftermath of the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan, Russia is looking south with a wary eye to see how it can benefit from a situation fraught with both opportunity and risk. VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir reports.
Although it officially labels the Taliban a terrorist organization, Russia has been engaging with its leaders for years, even inviting them to Moscow. As Western nations view the U.S. and NATO's exit with anxiety, Moscow has struck a softer tone. Russia's UN envoy, Vasily Nebenzia, spoke to the Security Council a day after the Taliban swept into Kabul. He is heard here through an interpreter.
Currently, we believe that there is no point in panicking. The main point is that a widespread bloodbath among civilians has been avoided. We urge all Afghan parties to refrain from hostilities and to foster a settlement peacefully.
Moscow had its own intervention in Afghanistan in 1979. Its troops invaded to prop up a communist government fighting Islamist rebels known as the Mujahideen. What was supposed to be a quick military operation dragged on for nearly a decade. Soon after the Soviet withdrawal, the communist regime collapsed. Today, Moscow has taken a more pragmatic position. Mark Simakovsky, senior non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council via Skype.
Moscow is very eager to take advantage of a perceived power vacuum. And so they are on the ground. They are not going to be removing their embassy. I think they would be one of likely the first countries potentially to recognize the Taliban, although I think we're still far away from that potential point.
Russia is keen to prevent the export of Islamist extremists and fighters to Central Asia, and it hopes the Taliban will curb the flow of illicit drugs to its region. Meantime, the U.S. withdrawal has been a propaganda gift for Moscow.
Of course, Afghanistan also matters internationally for Russia as a showcase of the weakness of the United States, which also benefits Russia significantly as a talking point and an example in its efforts in places like Ukraine and Venezuela and elsewhere.
Ultimately, it seems clear that Moscow hopes to fill the vacuum left by America's departure to boost its own regional influence. Margaret Bashir, VOA News.
Iran's new top diplomat, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, appears to be focusing his efforts on Arab states in a bid to achieve a thaw in long-frozen relations with Tehran's Arab and Gulf neighbors. The effort comes amid a proxy war in Yemen that involves Iran and Saudi Arabia. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Iran's regional proxies turned up the heat on nemesis Saudi Arabia this week, striking Saudi-controlled Anad airbase near Aden, Yemen on Sunday and Abha airport on Saudi soil in a drone bomb attack early Tuesday. Reports say 8 people were injured in Tuesday's attack, which the Saudis blamed on Iran-backed Houthi rebels. There was no immediate comment from the rebels. The incidents follow overtures by Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian towards Arab adversaries at a recent regional summit in Baghdad. Abdollahian's first appearance at the top diplomatic gathering since assuming the post of foreign minister last week was marked by an appeal for regional cooperation. Some Arab leaders appeared to resent Abdollahian's presence, along with his attempt to win over his audience by speaking Arabic. Abdollahian's Iraqi hosts were openly seeking a diplomatic breakthrough by prompting a thaw in relations between Tehran and its top regional adversaries, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Abdollahian also blamed outside players for regional tensions, apparently alluding to the United States and its allies. Abdollahian says that Iran continues to insist on achieving peace based on dialogue and regional efforts, and that Iran hopes these countries come to the realization that the only way to do that is through mutual confidence of the countries in the region based on strengthening dialogue and avoiding outside interference. It was not clear if Abdollahian succeeded in changing long-standing positions of Saudi Arabia and the UAE. A Sunday visit to Syria's capital, Damascus, appeared unlikely to soften regional ill feelings over Iran's domination of Arab states like Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Yemen. The attacks on Anad airbase and on Abha airport also seemed unlikely to improve ties with Riyadh. Iranian analyst and former diplomat Mirdad Kansari tells VOA that Saudi Arabia is being forced to soften its position toward Iran despite the fact that it dislikes the Islamic Republic.
Yemen has been a total disaster for them, and they know that they can't get out of Yemen without Iranian assistance and without some sort of Iranian hold to the kind of support that they're providing the Houthis. And at the same time, they don't like having to do what they're having to do. So they are doing something where they're having to walk a line which they absolutely detest, and it's been essentially forced upon them.
Washington-based Gulf analyst Theodore Karasik tells VOA that he thinks the new Iranian foreign minister is quickly showing what he is made of. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
This is the Voice of America. A new report from the United Nations Weather Agency finds the world is getting several times more weather disasters than in the 1970s, and they are costing 7 times more than in the past, even when adjusted for inflation. But Wednesday's World Meteorological Organization reports find that these disasters are killing far fewer people. Experts say that's because of better warnings and preparations, but they say climate change is increasing the number and strength of weather disasters while people are increasingly moving into harm's way. Louisiana residents still reeling from flooding and damage caused by Hurricane Ida are scrambling for food, gas, water, and relief from the oppressive heat. Meanwhile, thousands of line workers are toiling to restore electricity, and officials have vowed to set up more sites where people can get free meals and cool off. Ida knocked out power to more than 1 million people, including all of New Orleans. Iran's judiciary say that prosecutors have opened criminal cases against six guards at the country's notorious Evin prison after footage showing abuses of detainees at the facility leaked out last week. A spokesman said on Tuesday that the judiciary's three-day investigation into mistreatment of the Tehran prison had landed, quote, some, unquote, guards in detention. The spokesman says authorities summoned two guards and punished others. He didn't elaborate on the penalties. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The International Committee of the Red Cross says more than 48,000 people are missing across Africa and at least 21,600 are minors. Most of the registered disappearances, widely believed to be a fraction of the continent's wider undocumented humanitarian tragedy, are linked to armed conflicts, violence, disasters, and migration across the continent. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
The International Committee of the Red Cross says the number of people coming forward to report missing persons is on the rise in Africa. Amaya Fernandez, the humanitarian organization's advisor on the missing and their families for Western Africa, says the cause of the increasing numbers is twofold.
On one hand, the fact that we are trying to register more and more systematically cases of missing persons throughout the region, but also, certainly due to the significant increase of violence and conflict experienced in the continent, which increase at the same time the likelihood of going missing. Looking at our figures, we can summarize that almost half of the missing persons that have been recorded are underage. Most of them, the majority, are men. And among the women that are searched by their families, we can see that the majority are minors.
The ICRC finding shows that 39,360 of the 48,000 missing people are from seven countries with armed conflicts. According to the Stockholm International Peace and Research Institute, 20 countries in Africa have armed conflicts. Out of the 20, 10 are witnessing high-intensity armed conflicts. Fernandez says the ongoing conflict in some African countries has created more pain and suffering for families of missing persons.
Humanitarian consequences, particularly caused by protracted armed conflicts, often aggravated, and this is reflected in most of the interviews. For instance, half of the families that were interviewed in Nigeria reported that their relatives had gone missing in 2014-2015. In South Sudan, majority also the families were looking for people that went missing between 2013 and 16. In Libya, families reported that they were looking for missing relatives since the late 70s until the present day. And the same goes for families in Asia.
Some experts see the need to train community workers and security agencies on the importance of information sharing to help locate missing persons. Zimbabwe's Assistant Police Commissioner Crispin Leifer says his country and the region need a data management system to follow up on the missing person cases.
There is need to have a database which should continuously updated so that all missing persons and even those that are deceased, the information is captured in a database by police stations. And at the end of the day, that information has to be put in one place, in this case at the NCB, where if you want to check across the country, the number of missing persons will quickly get that information from a central point.
Fauzia Hussein's brother went missing in June after a Kenyan court released him. The 39-year-old was accused of terrorism-related issues, but the court found him innocent and ordered the police to release him. His sister, Fauzia Hussein, says they never saw him again.
I know that they still have him because at every point my brother got a chance to make a phone call, he called my mother. So if he was released, why wouldn't he call my mom? So I know for a fact that they did not release him.
According to Hussein, police told her they released her brother. The ICRC calls on African governments to prevent disappearances and help with search and identification and addressing families' needs. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
South African scientists have identified a new coronavirus variant that shares many mutations with some of the world's most dominant variants. But the WHO has said the new variant does not seem to be spreading rapidly. David Doyle of Reuters has more.
South African scientists have detected a new coronavirus variant. And C.1.2, as it's called, has them worried.
A little table.
That's because, according to a study, it contains many of the mutations associated with the most concerning variants the world has yet seen. But at the same time, the World Health Organization said on Tuesday that C.1.2 does not seem to be spreading.
The exact threat from this variant, we don't really know yet.
Richard Lessels is an infectious diseases expert and one of the study's authors.
The reason we were worried about the kind of combination of mutations was that many of the mutations we see in this C.1.2 are the same mutations we've seen in some of the other variants of concern, particularly the beta and the alpha and the gamma. But it's in a different combination.
Lessell said that the main fears are that C.1.2 is especially transmissible or is able to get around some of the immunity provided by either vaccines or prior infection. He said the new variant, which was first detected in May, may have more immune evasion properties than the fast-spreading Delta variant based on its pattern of mutations. Laboratory tests are underway to establish how well the variant is neutralized by antibodies. Lessels said C.1.2 is a reminder to South Africa and the world that the pandemic is not yet over.
When we get to the kind of come out of another wave, we want to think that's the last wave or that's the worst of it over. But this virus is still changing. It is still finding ways to keep infecting people. And we have to take that seriously and we have to do everything we can to bring down the rates of transmission.
The South African study's findings have been flagged to the WHO. On Tuesday, a WHO spokesperson said C.1.2 did not appear to be increasing in circulation, adding that it was not currently classified as a variant of concern.
All right, Ibe.
However, the spokesperson said that the WHO will continue to monitor the variant as the virus evolves.
That's David Doyle of Reuters. Brazilian researchers have found that a molecule in the venom of a type of snake inhibited coronavirus reproduction in monkey cells, a possible first step towards a drug to combat the virus causing COVID-19. This report is produced by Chris Dingham of Reuters.
This highly venomous snake could hold a key to fighting the virus that causes COVID-19. At least that's the hope of these researchers in Brazil, who say they found that a molecule in the venom of the deadly Jara rakusu pit viper inhibited coronavirus reproduction in monkey cells by 75%, a possible first step toward a drug to combat the disease.
It's the first step in a long journey. The process is a very long one.
Professor Rafael Guido of the University of Sao Paulo authored the study.
We were able to see that the peptides in the venom not only inhibited the development of the virus in vitro, inside the cell, but we were also able to see here in the lab that it was able to inhibit one of the proteins that is very important for the virus's ability to multiply.
Guido said the peptide or chain of amino acids can be synthesized in a lab, making the capture or raising of the snakes unnecessary. But Giuseppe Puorto, who specializes in the study of reptiles and runs the Butantan Institute's biological collection in Sao Paulo, still worries people will go out looking for the deadly viper, one of the largest snakes in Brazil, measuring up to 6 feet long.
We are afraid that people will go hunting for the snake all over Brazil, thinking it will save the world or themselves or their family. That's not the case. Is this an important discovery? Without a doubt it is. But chasing after the animal is not how this pandemic will be resolved.
A statement from the State University of Sao Paulo said researchers will next evaluate the efficacy of different doses of the molecule and whether it is able to prevent the virus from entering cells in the first place. They hope to test the substance in human cells soon, but did not give a timeline.
That's Chris Dingham of Reuters. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a great evening.